This public radio podcast is supported by Constellation Energy, a global provider of fuels, power, and energy services, committed to environmentally sound, energy efficient, and sustainable energy solutions. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If you're underwater on your mortgage, meaning you owe more than your home is worth, it may be impossible to swim to shore. You know, pay your debts. Well, today, the chairman of the Federal Reserve urged lenders to start tossing out life vests. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working to help reduce greenhouse gases with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. He's in Dubai preparing for our broadcast from the Middle East next week. It is Tuesday, the fourth day of March. Glad to have you with us. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke was back talking about the mortgage mess today. He told bankers in Florida that it's in their own interest to do more to help homeowners avoid foreclosure. His suggestion? Lop off some of the principal they owe on their mortgages and hopefully keep them from going, in Bernanke's words, underwater. From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports the whole idea has banks more than a little squeamish.
Bernanke acknowledged lenders will be reluctant to trim the size of their loans, especially since they'd come under pressure to write down the principal again if home prices continue to fall. But Congressman Barney Frank, the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, welcomed Bernanke's call for more responsibility from lenders.
What we're saying to the lenders is, guys, you made mistakes, and that isn't worth what you thought it was going to be worth. It's not worth literally that paper that it's written on. And you have two choices. You can try to collect legally what you're entitled to and wind up with nothing, with foreclosure, with a lot of grief. Or you can write this down to a reasonable level, accept the fact that you overlent, take some losses, but not lose everything.
Once the loan more accurately reflects the value of the home, Frank says the Federal Housing Authority could step in to ensure the refinanced loan. But Peter Wallison at the American Enterprise Institute says the plan only works if the borrower has made at least a 10% down payment on the house.
If the write-down idea results in the homeowner getting a loan from the government, which is 97, 98, or even 100% of the value of the written down property, the homeowner is likely to default in the future. And as a result, we will have the government bearing many of the losses that lenders are now bearing.
Some bank managers predict there'll be a lot of industry opposition to Bernanke's idea, especially from bankers who feel they've been responsible in their mortgage lending. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
One salvage program the banking industry did sign on to was the Bush administration's Hope Now initiative. It was created last fall to assist borrowers who were falling behind on their house payments. Lenders would agree to freeze adjustable rate mortgages instead of allowing them to reset. The Hope Now Alliance released figures this week showing that about 150,000 subprime loans have been modified since the program's inception. Joining us now to talk about these efforts is U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. Welcome to the program, Mr. Secretary.
Tess, it's good to be with you.
Are we better off than, say, 6 months ago before the government's rescue efforts, or is the housing situation getting worse?
Tess, the housing situation is getting worse. So I think the right question to ask yourself, though, is are we better off than we would have been if we hadn't had the government's efforts? And the answer there is a resounding yes, because what we've seen is since this Hope Alliance network was put together, the response rate has increased. It's gone from 2 to 3% to 20%. Now, still 80% aren't talking with anyone about solutions. And if you don't talk with someone, you can't be helped.
One criticism of that effort, the Hope Now Alliance, is that the vast majority of those workouts are simply delaying the inevitable. The terms of the loans don't change. And in fact, that's the case for about 75% of the workouts so far. Is it possible to resolve this crisis without changing the terms of these mortgage agreements?
Well, if a homeowner is able to avoid a step up in the interest rate or a reset, that's a major change in terms. But let me step back a minute. The biggest help we've all received has been the cut in interest rates. Before we'd had this change, if a mortgage holder had a $200,000 mortgage, their payment would have gone up $300 a month. Now it's going up about $70 a month. And many fewer adjustable rate mortgage holders need help.
The Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, said today that the programs to date simply aren't enough. He suggested that banks may have to actually reduce principal amounts on some of these mortgages in order to allow people to afford their homes. The bank would basically swallow the difference so that homeowners regain some equity. Would you support that idea?
Tess, what I'm very supportive of is bringing the lenders, the servicers, and homeowners together. And there will be instances where lenders are going to clearly see that the best solution for them, and which is less costly than a foreclosure, is going to be a write-down of principal on a mortgage. They will do that in some instances. In other instances, they will go with a modification in the terms. The only point that I've made is that if you own a home and you can afford to pay your mortgage payment, then you have an obligation to do so. And if you decide to walk away from that obligation, then the government, the taxpayer, should not be paying for your losses any more than they should have been paying for the losses of the day trader that speculated in technology stocks in 2000.
Do you have any proposals for regulating the industry, given that a lot of these people got mortgages that they couldn't afford because the banks gave them to them?
Tess, that's a very good question. And the key there will be to come up with a regulatory blueprint, because our regulatory system is a good one, but it is not perfect. It's far from perfect, and it's a patchwork quilt, and it could be improved, because a good deal of fraud took place here, and I think it's very important that wrongdoers be dealt with expeditiously.
Mr. Secretary, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. It was good to be with you today.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson joined us from his office in Washington. Our full conversation is online at marketplace.org. The Bush administration is still relying heavily on the banking industry to solve the mortgage mess. But by all indications, things are going to get worse before they get better for the banks themselves. Today, the leader of a Dubai-owned investment firm warned that it's going to take, as he put it, a lot more money to rescue the nation's largest bank, Citigroup. We asked Marketplace's Bob Moon to take a look.
Shares in Citigroup sank as much as 6% on that news, but recovered a bit to close down 4%. Jeff Kane writes for Portfolio. He says it's clear Middle East investors are packing a lot of influence, enough to move the markets.
I think if you look at how investors are reacting to what was said in Dubai, driving the shares of Citigroup down sharply, I mean, they put a lot of weight. I think they're being recognized as important, even savvy investors.
Maybe even savvier than they counted on. While billions of dollars have been invested in Citigroup by an Abu Dhabi-based wealth fund, today's pessimism came from the head of a rival Persian Gulf fund based in Dubai. Kane finds that curious.
Dubai International Capital is a significant shareholder in HSBC, the big British bank that in many ways is the only real rival to Citigroup in terms of global reach, in terms of global cachet. He's making comments about investments by other Persian Gulf funds at the same time that his fund has a stake in a rival.
So while there's little doubt that Citigroup has big troubles, investors might want to consider the source. Bunk Ziegel analyst Dick Beauvais says just because a Middle East fund is flush with cash doesn't mean they know any more than you or me.
The belief is that they somehow have inside information concerning Citigroup, which would be inappropriate and illegal. Therefore, what he's saying simply represents just one more opinion.
Analyst analysts who follow Citigroup do say they see even deeper losses in the weeks ahead, but Beauvais says that really shouldn't come as a surprise to investors. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Well, on Wall Street, investors didn't react kindly to the Citigroup news today. Details when we do the numbers. Please forgive me for this line, but there's a new wrinkle in the Botox business. The Department of Justice is investigating how Allergan, the drug's parent company, promotes it. The feds want to know if Allergan is touting Botox as a treatment for headaches, a use which has not been approved by the FDA. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has more.
Botox isn't just used for cosmetic touch-ups. Half of its annual sales come from therapeutic uses, treating things like uncontrollable blinking and muscle spasms. Allergan is currently testing Botox as a treatment for headaches. Doctors can prescribe it for such off-label uses, but the company can't market the drug as a headache cure without FDA approval. The Justice Department wants to know if Allergan jumped the gun. Spokeswoman Caroline Van Hove says it didn't.
It is our policy that our products are only promoted in a manner that's consistent with the FDA-approved labeling for our products.
Even if the feds find otherwise, the fallout isn't expected to be major. Jeff Vixjoe is a stock analyst with Morningstar.
Any fine levied is likely to be manageable given Allergan's size. It's an $18 billion company. And taking away those off-label sales are going to be very small to Botox's overall sales total.
While off-label sales of Botox to treat headaches may be small, some observers say the drug depends on other off-label sales. So says Peter Lurie with Public Citizen.
This is a drug that is surviving primarily by off-label uses.
For cosmetic use, the FDA has approved Botox only to fight wrinkles in that space between the eyes. Injecting Botox in some other part of the face is considered off-label. Whether or not it's used according to the instructions on the label, demand is strong. Last year, worldwide sales of Botox exceeded $1 billion. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
While we're on the subject of facelifts, Atlantic City is in the middle of one. It's lost a whole lot of business to tribal casinos up and down the East Coast. New slot parlors in Delaware and Pennsylvania got the blame for the first drop in revenues in Atlantic City since the 1970s. But big casino operators aren't ready to fold just yet. This week, they agreed to keep subsidizing New Jersey's horse tracks as long as they don't install video slot machines. And as Joel Rose tells us, some casinos are doubling down.
When you hear the words Atlantic City, the first thing that comes to mind might be little old ladies arriving in town by bargain bus. Larry Mullen wants you to think valet parking.
What you're looking at there is what would be the retail space that will take you into the front lobby, and then all surrounding that area is indoor and outdoor pools. You look up to the 32nd floor. You can't
Mullen
see
is CEO of the Borgata, a hotel and casino in Atlantic City. He's looking up at the Water Club, a $400 million luxury hotel and spa at the Borgata that's set to open this summer. Mullen says it will have four swimming pools, a rooftop spa, and zero slot machines in the lobby.
It allows us to, you know, go out and reach out to a customer that has been rejecting the market. And we think now with the amenities we can offer that customer that it's on a par with any destination.
Resort destinations like Las Vegas, or closer to home, Foxwoods in Connecticut, which bills itself as the largest casino complex in North America. By one estimate, Atlantic City has $10 billion worth of new hotels and casinos in the pipeline. This may seem an unlikely time for a building boom, since overall revenues here were off more than 5% last year.
Atlantic City is evolving and growing, not despite the fact that it's lost its monopoly, because it's lost its monopoly.
Gaming industry analyst Michael Pollack says new slots parlors in Delaware and Pennsylvania have lured away some loyal customers who used to make day trips to the Jersey Shore.
So Atlantic City is essentially following the business model of Las Vegas in that it's going after a much broader demographic, affluent adults who have the two commodities that casinos need, one being time, the other being money.
Atlantic City is also following Las Vegas' lead by tearing down and starting over. Last October, Pinnacle Entertainment imploded the old Sands Casino Hotel to make way for a new one on the boardwalk. Casino operators here are betting more luxury hotel rooms and more entertainment options will continue to draw people like Terry Higgins. She drove all the way up from Maryland's Eastern Shore to gamble at the Borgata, even though she could have stayed closer to home.
It's a beautiful place. It's clean. It's a gorgeous hotel. In Delaware, they don't really have the hotels and the facilities with the slot machines.
Do you like the restaurants and stuff?
Excellent restaurants. Excellent. And there's none around our area. Yeah.
The table may soon get even more crowded on the East Coast, with Massachusetts talking about legalized gambling. That could draw business away from Foxwoods, the massive Connecticut casino owned by the Mashantucket Pequot tribe. Gary Armantrout is president of the Foxwoods Development Company.
It will have an immediate impact, but I think that in the long term, those patrons, perhaps introduced to gaming for the first time in a local casino, will eventually want to come and visit the mega property at Foxwoods.
Armantrout insists the New England market isn't saturated yet, even though Foxwoods is putting its chips behind new casinos in Pennsylvania, Kansas, and California. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Coming up, old problems, new deals, and one man's singular vision.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive, and will prosper.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks were mixed today. Banks fell on worries about eroding profits, but news of a possible bailout for bond insurer Ambac lifted some investor spirits. The Dow fell more than a third of a percent, 45 points, to close at 12,213. The Nasdaq, however, ticked up 1 point to end at 2260. The S&P lost half a percent, 7 points, to finish at 1323. As we heard earlier, Citigroup had a 4.25% loss today. Bank of America and Goldman Sachs both fell about a percent. Ambac rose just shy of 8% on those bailout hopes. Amazon booked more than a 4% gain after the company confirmed its earnings forecast. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.61%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. Middle East reporting on Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. And by Cleveland Clinic, expanding globally and committed every day to providing innovative treatments and hope to patients worldwide. Online at clevelandclinic.org. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve Board releases its latest Beige Book survey of regional economic conditions. The Senate Special Aging Committee discusses elderly Americans going hungry. And on March 5th, 1963, toy developer Arthur Mellon finally got a patent for the hula hoop. The toy made a lot of hoopla 5 years earlier. About 25 million hula hoops were sold in the first 4 months of production. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl, who's on assignment in Dubai.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Starting off our letters segment this week, the unbearable lightness of compact fluorescent bulbs, at least for some of you. A story last week discussed the reasons why lots of well-meaning people won't use CFLs. Justin Schmidt of Spokane, Washington, says his biggest complaint is they can't be dimmed. Well, actually, they can. You'll just have to pay around $10 each for dimmable CFL bulbs. Sue Findlay hears us in Anchorage, Alaska. She points out that with half her year spent in darkness, she has to be choosy about the way she lights up her life.
The quality of light is both visually and viscerally offensive. The color of the light is the visual equivalent of running your fingernails down a blackboard.
And many of you wrote in with concerns about the mercury in CFLs. We're working up a full story on that controversy. Last week, we brought you the story of an eco-attraction that's a little further afield, an elephant sanctuary that's a big tourist draw in Thailand. Ron Pine of Lawrence, New York, has another suggestion for making a buck off elephants, or at least their byproducts.
When I worked for Ringling Brothers Circus, they solved their similar problem. Ringling Brothers discovered that all that stuff was actually a very good fertilizer. They gathered it all and sold it in baggies under the title Ponderous Pachyderm Poop. It sold like hotcakes.
And finally, in a story looking at proposed rules for sovereign wealth funds, economist Matthew Slaughter was identified as being with Dartmouth University. That got the attention of several Big Green alums. For the record, it's Dartmouth College. Send us your comments, compliments, and complaints. Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. Today marks the 75th anniversary of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's first inaugural address. From that moment and for the next 12 years, FDR went to work rescuing an economy from the throes of the Great Depression. It came to be known as the New Deal. And for a look back, we're joined by a familiar voice. Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at UC Berkeley and a regular commentator on this program. Today, he's our historian. And Bob, let me first ask you to set the scene for us. It's March 4th, 1933.
Well, remember, the country was in desperate economic shape. Franklin D. Roosevelt was elected in a landslide in November of 1932 to make a change, to right the balance, to do something.
And that started pretty much right away with his first inaugural address. Let's listen to this clip from the beginning of that address as FDR was taking office.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Bob, of course, this is one of the more famous lines in recent history, but I think a lot of people out there may not realize that it was indeed referring to the economy, not foreign aggression.
Yes. The great fear at that time was that the economy would continue to do badly, would be worse than ever. Remember, there's a psychological component to economics. When people don't trust banks to keep their deposits, when they don't trust really that the economy is going to be there for them, people act in ways that almost create a self-fulfilling prophecy. And that's what FDR was alluding to. It wasn't just psychology, obviously. It was also some other inconvenient facts, such as the monetary system wasn't working. The Federal Reserve Board was not pumping out nearly enough money. Nobody knew the importance of generating a lot of additional liquidity in a situation like the Great Depression. And, of course, the stock market was still completely frozen.
So in very basic terms, what was the New Deal? Why was it so radical at the time?
Nobody before 1933 conceived of the federal government as having a major role to play in regulating or in stimulating the national economy. The dominant political and economic philosophy was laissez-faire. Just leave it alone. Well, that changed pretty rapidly. I mean, people knew something dramatically had to be done.
And so what was the proposal?
There wasn't one proposal, Tess. It was much more trial and error. Roosevelt didn't really know what he was doing. His economic advisors didn't know either. There was no precedent for this. They started kind of an alphabet soup of agencies. The WPA, Works Projects Administration, the Securities and Exchange Commission, National Labor Relations Act, they enacted a whole bunch of social safety nets, social security, unemployment insurance. All of these were kind of groping in the dark. Some answer to what could possibly be done to get the economy going again. Nobody knew what to do. trial and error.
Let's go to another clip, and I have to say this seems particularly relevant today.
There must be a strict supervision of all banking and credits and investments. There must be an end to speculation with other people's money. And there must be provision for an adequate but sound currency.
This was just ripped from today's headlines. Could have been in a campaign speech.
Sounds like it could be any one of our candidates.
Yeah.
You see, you have to understand some background. Leading up to the great crash of 1929, there was huge debt. The United States and many, many individuals, corporations, very, very deeply indebted. A great concentration of wealth and income, larger than it is today, and also rampant speculation. And these three conjured up a very dangerous brew, which ultimately blew up. Roosevelt understood that something had to be done to end speculation. There was no regulation to speak of. One of his goals was to make the market work, not to replace the market.
Bob, we often hear that the New Deal is dead. Do you think that's true?
Well, it's certainly dead in terms of some of the agencies. The National Recovery Administration was struck down by the Supreme Court. The Works Projects Administration was ended by World War II. Also, I think it's fair to say that Americans today feel they have less need for and certainly less confidence in government. There are certain legacies that nobody can deny, not only Social Security, unemployment insurance, agencies like the Securities and Exchange Commission. But there's also, Tess, I think, still the notion that when things get very bad, government has to be there as a kind of a last resort. We're seeing the debate now with regard to the housing crisis, the credit crunch. The question in Washington and around the country and indeed around the world is what should government do to make the markets work better? That probably is the enduring legacy.
Well, Robert Rice, thank you so much for joining us for this look back at 75 years after the New Deal with Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Thank you, Tess.
Robert Rice is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book is called Supercapitalism. For extended audio of FDR's speeches, go to our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, residents of the Northern California city of Vallejo let out a collective sigh of relief today. The city brokered a deal that will keep its budget in the black for now. We reported on Vallejo's financial problems last week. The city's been hit hard by a municipal bond market gone awry. To keep bankruptcy at bay, firefighters and policemen took pay cuts, and the arts and transportation sectors also sacrificed some future funds. Some residents fear this is only a temporary fix to the looming fiscal mess. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 45 points, more than a third of a percent. The Nasdaq added 1 point, less than a tenth of a percent. And the S&P shaved off 7 points, half a percent. Thanks to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Next time on the program, here's what you don't want consumers to say about your company's logo.
It looks like a baseball that got drunk.
Yikes. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.